eyes wide open. You mentioned the story about the American Friends Service Committee and their, I was going to call it an exhibit, but it was more of a...
It was an exhibit.
An exhibit, yeah, of these thousands of pairs of empty boots, suggesting this is part of the loss of yeah, of the Iraq War. You've got a quote in there, empty saddles in the old corral, where do they ride tonight? And this was, the line before it says, when I was a child, frightened of the night and crying in my bed, my father told me a poem or sang. He sang this. Can you tell a little bit about that story?
Empty saddles in the old corral, where do they ride tonight?
You didn't sing it last night.
It was a 1930s cowboy song.
Yeah.
You know, sloppy, silly, romantic, but kind of charming in a hokey way. And of course, when you're a kid, wow, you know. I grew up on a horse. I was, we'll use my boot as a begging bowl for an ashtray. I grew up in a cowboy culture, and I apparently was a pretty badly abused infant, and I had the night terrors. So I, you know, going to bed was a really scary time for me, because I didn't know whether I was going to have nightmares, or you know whether I would actually sleep. And him reciting poems or reading poems or singing some of these cowboy songs would really calm me down, and I'd have him sing it again, and the second time through I'd start falling asleep, and maybe the third time through it I would drift off into sleep.
Yeah. This was your adopted family.
Yeah.
And this was in Utah.
Yeah.
Born in Northern California, but raised in Utah.
Yeah.
Till you ran away at about age, what, 13, 14?
14.
14 years old.
Yeah.
And you ran from there to San Francisco?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was Rex.
I got busted in Reno, sent back, stayed a couple of months, ran away again at 15, and that was when I pretty much stayed away until I went back and tried to spend a little bit of time in high school. Because Kenneth had convinced me that, you know, you got to have an education.
Kenneth Rexroth.
However you're going to get it, you got to get it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was doing some pretty bad shit on the streets in San Francisco. So I went back to take a shot at high school. You can imagine trying to go to a high school in Holiday, Utah, after having spent most of a year hanging out with, you know, people like Kenneth Rexroth. So that wasn't working out. So I knew I needed some discipline, so I enlisted in the Marine Corps for a ticket out of there.
At age?
17.
At 17.
Yeah.
And that was legal at the time?
Yeah.
Don't give them any ideas, huh? You might start that program up again. Back on page 17 of Measured by Stone, you were right, of course, the struggle for poetry in the world cannot take place in a museum. And that line's in quotes, the struggle for poetry.
There are poets that produce what I call a museum of ideas. And I'm not going to name names because that's sort of pointless. It's distracting. Because what I'm talking about is the idea of being alive in a living language and trying to find the truth of the essential experience of this or that or the other. Being receptive to the change that is constant within all of us. My theory about fixed forms is that they tend to invite people to think in fixed ideas, which is why you have so many fixed meters. Whereas in actual life, it doesn't come at you that way. It's in bits and pieces and starts and jumps and leaps and sometimes flowing very smoothly like a river, sometimes blowing apart like a tire. So this sort of museum of ideas is like, for instance, romantic poetry. I mean, to most of us these days, an actual romantic poem sounds pretty bad, you know. It's got end rhyme, it's probably in pentameter, and, you know, you're sort of talking about your emotions rather than actually having any emotions or actually stirring any emotions. For me, the function of the poem is to sort of tell its tale, but to do it with an emotional base that is felt as well as reasoned.
Zhukovsky's quote comes to mind, and he said, only emotion objectified endures.
Well, yeah.
The next thing is on that same page in that same poem. We're talking about the poem "Arguing with Milosz and Vilnius," and you say here the poem "A Record of Survival." Why don't you flesh that out a little bit?
Well, in the context of Miłosz, of course, he's a World War II exile who, you know, took up home in France, from which he basically exiled himself to the United States. I'm an orphan. That makes me a permanent exile. I'm an atheist in a basically religious country. Another kind of exile, philosophical exile, existentialism. And simply being a poet in a culture like this creates a kind of exile, because we're uncommon. I mean, we're very uncommon people with uncommon likes and dislikes and passions. So, you know, it's not a big stretch.
So the poem written by you or someone like you is as a record of survival. This is the daily task of trying to exist in a culture that doesn't appreciate poetry.
Well, trying to live reasonably in an irrational culture.
You say that being a poet in this culture is rare, but yet we've had in the last 20 years an explosion of MFA programs and creative writing programs, and as a result, an explosion of poets. You said last night, everybody's a poet and everybody's an editor.
Well, in a way, that's true. And I think that's altogether basically a good thing. We've created a kind of target audience for poetry, and I think that's a little bit dangerous. And we've also created a kind of business class of poets. And I think this is what people really object to when they badmouth the MFA programs, the way it gets into, turned into a little corner of academia. It'd be much better for our culture if a lot of those people would get out of academia and come and live in the real world, as it were. It'd be nice if I wasn't, you know, the only regularly publishing poet in Anacortes, which I guess I am. I don't know of another one. Because I know there are people here who write poetry. You can find them on among the 30,000 poems at Poets Against War. And it's the way, you know, there are millions of painters as well, but how many really serious painters are there at any given point? Well, there's quite a few, but they're not in the thousands, you know, maybe in the hundreds.
So the danger in this business class category for poets is that they run the risk of creating this kind of elitism that's separate from people that...
Well, I'm not opposed to elitism, you know. When people use that word in the pejorative, I just think, you know, I spent a lot of years trying to get a grip on classical Chinese and Japanese poetry and philosophy. And the people who have translated that stuff with any degree of success, that's a very small club. And I'm happy to be a member of that club. You want to kill this for a second?
Sure.